Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 51 of the Delgado Podcast, a show featuring academics, authors, artists, and people who challenge what we think and help us to grow in more empathy and compassion. In this week's episode, we're honored to learn from Valerie Brown about ways to cultivate hope, compassion, and mindfulness amid seasons of grief and loss. It's the topic of her fantastic new book entitled Hope Leans Forward, Braving Your Way Towards Simplicity, Awakening, and Peace. Valerie Brown is a Buddhist Quaker Dharma teacher, facilitator, and executive coach. She's a former lawyer and lobbyist and co-director of Georgetown's Institute for Transformational Leadership, as well as founder and chief mindfulness officer of Lead Smart Coaching. She's an ordained Buddhist Dharma teacher in the Plum Village tradition and an award-winning author whose books include The Road That Teaches and The Mindful School Leader with Kristen Olson. She holds a Juris Doctorate from Howard University School of Law, a Master's of Arts from Miami University, and a Bachelor of Arts from City University of New York. In today's episode, she talks about writing Hope Leans Forward during a time of grief and loss. She discusses the importance of tending to your grief. She talks about why we don't want to think about our pain, how to find hope after dealing with trauma and suffering. She talks about the importance of naming our trauma and why that is so important for dealing with emotional pain. She shares how Buddhism, meditation, and Dharma rituals helped her hold pain, reduce anxiety, and grow in compassion. She also talks about the practice of cultivating a soul friendship and what that means. And at the end of the podcast, she talks about how to explore our emotions and ways to create habits of noticing how we're feeling. As always, you can get notes from today's podcast, watch the video clips, and get links to her brand new book on my website at mikedelgado.org. Here's our conversation. Well, Valerie, thank you so much for coming on the podcast to talk about your brand new book. I wanted to start by asking you a little bit about the process for you to sit down and write this and what led to the writing of this book.
Yeah, well, I'm just so delighted to be here and to have an opportunity to share about Hope Leans Forward, my new book, with you and with your audience. So process and what led me to writing the book. So writing is a process. And I would say this was a book that I could not write. Hmm. In many ways, I would have preferred not to write this kind of a book. I'm actually thinking about another book that I want to write. But you know, writing feels very much like giving birth. You're compelled. Something bigger, you know, stronger than me is trying to come forward. And so the process of writing the book was really listening to what wanted to come forward. And by listening, I mean paying attention to the cues and the complications that were happening in my life, and then coming to an understanding, which took time, of what these complications were and how they were affecting me. And so by that was the process. I often joke, half jokingly say to folks that I've been in my own global pandemic since 2016, and the rest of the world just joined me because I had one grief upon loss upon complication. And I really just wanted to try to figure out what is happening to me and how do I process this? And so it was that reflective process of not turning away, not denying, not sugarcoating, but really being with these life complications, and I'm happy to talk about them in particular, that led to the process of writing the book. So that was the process. And in terms of the book itself, I often describe it in two ways. One is it was my journey, which I think represents one individual, but I think might resonate with many, many people. My journey from identity crisis to a calling in my life. And another way to describe this is a book that it's kind of like Elizabeth Gilbert's Eat, Pray, Love. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, blockbuster.
Yeah.
And Eckhart Tolle's book, The Power of Now. So this book is like bringing both of those books together. So Eat, Pray, Love, kind of about following that inner voice, that inner vision, that calling, you know, in a way that's hopeful. And then Eckhart Tolle's work on the immense power of being present to what is happening right now. And so that's really what the book is about.
Hmm. Can you talk about this deep calling that you had for this book and needing to write during a period of tremendous grief and pain?
Yeah, so I realized in writing the book, actually, I realized that all of the pain and all of the grief that I was experiencing since 2016 didn't make me an oddball. That actually many people, especially now with COVID and what happened in 2020 and 2021 and continues to this day, is that this grief and loss and complications are very much a part of our lives. And so my working with it was really tending the grief. I guess that's the way I would say it. Much like a person would tend a garden. And by tending, I mean, we live in a culture that often says, you know, chin up, you know, or when are you going to get over it? Or we don't have literacy around loss and suffering and grief. And as a Buddhist, you know, and a Quaker, but particularly as a Buddhist, you know, one of the fundamental elements of the Buddhist teaching is that our lives have suffering. And so many people, when they hear that, like, I don't want to have anything more to do with any religion that's going to center suffering. And I don't blame them, you know. But that's not what the teachings really are about. The teachings are about that, you know, that our lives contain many things. That includes suffering, but also that includes a lot of joy and a lot of love. It's a both and. And so, again, in this process, what had happened to me personally, you know, in 2016, my dad passed away, and 2017, one of my brothers had a heart transplant, another family member committed suicide. My marriage fell apart in 2018. In 2019, he moved out. And then in 2020, my other brother passed away. Of course, COVID happened and the racial reckoning. And then last year, on September 1st, there was a hurricane. Hurricane Ida destroyed a part of my house. And then this year, my younger brother died. And so I had all of these tremendous traumas that were happening one after the next, after the next. And I'd actually, in an earlier version of the book, I had that kind of laundry list of traumas tucked away in the back of the book. And a friend who was an early reader of the book, she said, no, that's really the place to start. in talking about hope, you know, is why not start there? And I realized that I had just been high functioning, just kind of chin up and keep going, power through it. And, you know, oh, this person died. Well, let me arrange everything. Oh, there's a hurricane. Well, let me get, you know, going with that. And there's a divorce. Just, you know, keep going. And, you know, realizing I was in experiencing real loss, real grief, and real trauma.
How important is it for us to be labeling, because you named all these things specifically, and I'm curious about how important is it that we are being aware of these different traumas, these different life events that are impacting us, and naming them?
Yeah, I think there's real power in naming things as they are. And again, my experience was that I was so deeply involved in the mechanics of, you know, of all of these events that had happened. Just for example, with my brother's passing, being the executor of two estates and all of the responsibility. And so the emotional side of this, the spiritual side of the grief and the loss, was kind of put aside in service of getting stuff done. And so I realized that this is, you know, this is the way probably many of us function. And my training for much of my career was as an attorney. And so, you know, very, very high functioning, and not just an attorney, but a lobbyist. So very high functioning. And so that I really found a great deal of power in saying, yes, this thing happened to me, not denying it, not, you know, not trying to push it away, but naming it for what it is. And that the first step kind of in healing from these things is to be able to say and to name and to say, yes, this thing happened. That feels like an important step in the healing journey. But often because we don't want to, you know, re-traumatize, re-experience, or we're focused on the to-do list, that naming doesn't happen. And I do think that the naming is important.
How do you feel your spirituality, being a Quaker, being a Buddhist, being a teacher, how that helped you and or hurt you in this process as you were inundated with these hurtful, tragic experiences?
Yeah, so where it helped and where it hurt, just taking a note here. So where it was helpful, as a ordained Dharma teacher, you know, I started studying meditation and mindfulness in 1995, long before it was popular. In fact, I was a closet meditator. I was deeply ensconced in my big lawyer job as a lawyer and a lobbyist, and there was no way that I could even speak about being a meditator. It's like, what, are you kidding me? You'd be laughed out of the halls of Congress. I mean, like, give me a break. You know, so at least among the people that I was with, other lobbyists, other lawyers, yeah, in that environment, meditating wasn't a thing. And I have to say that I started in very, you know, for very selfish reasons because of high stress and high pressure. And it was beneficial to me. I saw where the practice was actually helping me over time to have less anxiety, to have less depression or less, certainly less anxiety for sure. To be a calmer person, to be a little bit more compassionate, you know, to have a not that type A hear trigger response. So there was more of a space between whatever was happening and my response to it. Less knee-jerk angry and resentful. So again, I didn't do it alone. It was through these practices that I was learning with the Plum Village community, and particularly Zen Master Thich Nhat Hanh, whom I began studying with in 1995, and the community. So I was greatly benefited by that. But within my business community, there was no place to share this because it was simply not acceptable. And, you know, again, I was in the closet. And it was having those practices of being able to stop, to pause, to call things what they were, to be able to look at the suffering that was happening and hold it. So the meditation allowed for a larger capacity within me to hold what was happening, because that is the practice of meditation, right? To be able to hold what's coming up in the moment and not turn away from it and not try to make it into something else. So to be able to, the bandwidth to hold things that were charged and were triggering and were difficult. And this is not something that I did alone, but in, you know, over time, over years with practice. And that is a very, very important element of the meditative practice, is to be able to hold, be less knee-jerk reactive, and also clarity, to be able to see, how am I feeling, and name that. And then the other major piece of the meditative practice that's developed over time is a little bit of a, over time, developing a sense, a little bit more and a little bit more over time, of softness, I would say. And I would say that's kind of a compassion, you know, that the more one practices allowing things to be as they are, it softens a person. It softened me and allowed me to have a little bit more compassion and tenderness, acceptance for myself, for the conditions of my life, and for other people. Where I felt I was hurt, certainly as a Dharma teacher in the Plum Village tradition, there's a very, you know, like many other lineages, there's a ranking order and a power, an order of power and rank. So the person who is ordained as a Dharma teacher, we even have a ceremony to support this person who becomes an ordained Dharma teacher. It's called the Lamp of Wisdom. And so one even receives a lamp, a little lamp that glows to say that the community has recognized that this person has had a lot of suffering, and that they have transformed that in some important ways. And so there's a kind of high bar, you know, that as a teacher, you put on a kind of pedestal, you know, to like a maybe a priest or a bishop or someone like that, you know. And so it was very hard for me to say, as a Dharma teacher, I'm getting divorced. My marriage is a wreck. You know, this is a broken thing. Because the kind of stereotype is that, you know, you have this happy life and a happy family, and that wasn't the case for me. And so to be able to say, you know, that that is not the case for me. But what I realized was our community, the world, people need all different kinds of role models. They need people who have gone through divorce and have done that with love and with compassion. And as a lawyer, I know how difficult that is. So we need all kinds of people. We need white, cisgendered, heterosexual people. We need trans people, Latinx people, Asian people. We need indigenous people. We need disabled people. We need all kinds of people, and for people to see themselves mirrored and back in whatever lineage we're in. And so it was important for people who may be struggling in whatever the relationship is to say, oh, there's a person who struggled, and yet still.
You talk about being intentional about going to meditation and holding the pain, naming the pain, holding it, and sitting with it. Can you talk about what that process is like? Because for me, like, I just want to avoid the pain. I want to avoid not thinking about the stress, you know, what's going on. So can you talk about, like, how important is it to be intentional, to go there, to go to those depths of despair, those pain, those dark nights of the soul, and just sitting? And what does that kind of look like for somebody who's never done it before?
Yeah, well, I'm totally with you about that. you won't get an argument out of me. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I would have preferred not. So avoidance as a strategy, it kind of backfires. You know, it's really not going to get you. In the long run, it's not a strategy. Short run, maybe for half hour or so. But in the long run, you can't outrun yourself. That's not going to happen. You know, especially something like avoidance and resistance. That's pretty strong. That's pretty strong stuff. So it's just not going to work. And it's true short-term gain. And you know, long-term suffering, actually. And so it's important for us to be, and the word that's coming to mind is planful about this. We can't hold all of it all at once. You know, we're not going to be able to do that. You can't take on something massive like this, like what I've described, all of these losses, these traumas. No, we cannot do that. But maybe a tiny bit. Maybe, you know, to feel, to recognize a tiny bit of what has happened. And by that, we develop a larger and larger, in bite-sized pieces, capacity. You know, when you're trying to practice anything new, whether it's skating on ice or swimming, you don't like go and dive into, you know, the Atlantic Ocean when you're learning how to swim. You know, you sit at the edge of the water and you take a look, and maybe you put a toe in, and maybe you go to the ankle, you know, but you do this on a slow and slow basis. And so that's what it was for me, just slowly. I also think this kind of thing, this kind of reflection, because it's so easy to be in aversion, You know, this is a natural result, a natural response to suffering. I mean, you don't keep your hand on a hot fire. So I think it's really important that we have what John O'Donohue and many others have described. The poet John O'Donohue describes as anamkara, or a soul friend, a friend, someone that we can be real with, someone that we can talk to, someone that can help us. In other words, at least one person, if not a trusted community. We cannot do this alone, no matter how bright or how wise or how trained a person is. We need other people. And so one of the things, the consequences of COVID and the isolation and loneliness, just not having the community of people or even one person that we can share with. And so it's really important to kind of to do a kind of inventory. And that's what I had to do, is like look around and see who is really there and adopt a squad of people, a committee, some people call it a committee, or just one friend who can be an anamkara. And what does that mean? That means we actually then need to put effort into that. Call the person, reach out to them, go for a walk. You know, the impulse to do this, most of us know this impulse, like, yeah, I really should reach out to somebody else, I really should, you know, that kind of thing. But it's actually now following up and doing something and scheduling it. And I've had to practice this myself. So like cultivating a soul friends and mentors and small circles of community of people that I can be with. So it's like concentric circles. So like a circle of peer Dharma teachers, then I have like two or three others, people that I connect with, and then one-on-one, like, this is my soul friend. We'll talk once a month or once every couple of months or something like that. Yeah.
I love that you have these different little communities of people you can go to for these different things. And I'm thinking about, for a lot of us who maybe don't have those friends, those circles that we can go to, how do we begin to kind of find our tribe, find that one person that we feel comfortable talking to about our struggles?
This is a real, real issue today. You know, Vivek Murthy, the Surgeon General, likened this kind of loneliness to chain smoking 15 cigarettes a day. I mean, we're in this true epidemic of isolation and loneliness. So this is a serious issue. So I just want to acknowledge that. And as with meditation, we should start small, with one person. I mean, what I did was, I actually did, and I'd been talking about this to other people and teaching this to other people, but I've actually done it myself, which is I just sat myself down and took like 10 minutes to do a friend inventory. Like, who are my real, real friends? Who are the people on the, you know, like I could maybe reach out to them? And then who are the people like they're just like on the outskirts? And, you know, it doesn't have to be a big deal, 10 minutes maybe. And you'll be able to see, okay, I have one or two people that's really, truly a friend. Now next comes the big thing, the vulnerable thing. But this is the nature of being human, is that we cannot escape our own vulnerability. You know, when we try to do that, that's going to backfire too, because just being human, we're super vulnerable. We're vulnerable to all of the stuff coming in, just the media, social media and whatever, but we're also vulnerable in our physical body. So vulnerability goes with the territory of being human. So if we can, we can say, okay, yeah, this is uncomfortable, hold that piece of it. Yeah, okay, let me reach out to this person. And I would reach out, like, start small, like something that is not a big risk, like not asking the person, like, could you tell me the deepest part of myself? No, but just say, hey, we haven't touched base in a while. Could we have like a, just go for a walk or grab a, you know, grab a coffee, and start there. Because with that, then, you know, you'll get a good sense. Okay, this person really wants to do this, and then see how that connection is. And if it's working, then say, hey, why don't we set up something for a month from now or a few weeks from now? But the risk taking is part of the muscle that we're building that then leads to the action. That risk, you know, and action kind of go hand in hand. They're part of the territory.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. That's really, really practical. And I love also something you said earlier about how do we become more tender with our grief, you know, acknowledging and being tender to it. And because I feel like sometimes our responses, and you talked about avoidance and why that's such a terrible response, but that sometimes are what we go to because it's like, I just need to get back to work. I need to, life is happening. I need to keep going. So avoidance only worked for so long, but like right. You said, it will eventually lead to more suffering. I know for me, when I'm going through something traumatic or going through a loss or grief, sadly, I go to anger. I get really, really angry. Mm-hmm. And I talked to a couple other friends who also, like, their default is to get angry. Mm-hmm. And can you talk about that response, and how do we move away from that?
So that's a really important point that you've raised of anger, and there's several things that's coming up for me. In the Buddhist tradition, we have a practice called, very important practice. There's two parts to the practice. The first part is to stop whatever you're doing. So if, you know, like you're getting busy, like doing a lot of stuff, cleaning the house because you want to avoid paying attention to what's happening.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. Or you're going to buy the Maserati because you don't want to pay attention. you don't want to deal with it. You know, the first part is to stop. And to stop moving so fast. And there's power in the stillness. Just stop and say, whoa, what is happening here? And when we stop, we begin then, you notice the second part is to actually look deeply. So to notice that I'm angry. And for myself, what I've noticed is anger is like my go-to move. You know, like I do anger so easy. I go into the supermarket and, you know, my favorite ice cream isn't there. I'm like pissed. So anger is like, I was growing up in Brooklyn. What can I say? You know, I do anger so easily. But then, because the second part of this is to look deeply, it's like, what's that about? And then I realize that the anger is so easy and so effortless for me. Like, it's just like automatic. And I actually, you know, it gives me like, I can, you know, it's just like, ah, rage, you know, anger. Mm-hmm. I can just mm-hmm. get that out. But like many people have said, realizing that the anger is like up here and that above the waterline and below the waterline was a lot of other feelings, like feeling like unlovable, or feeling immense regret, or feeling sadness, like deep sadness. And because that was real hard to feel that, you know, the anger, since it's so easy for me, mm-hmm. but to feel like sad, the enormity of it, and to really, you know, to again, like the swimming metaphor, to just to touch that, that was a lot harder for me. But as I was able to touch a little bit of the sadness and that part that the anger was pointing to, the anger was pointing to that, I was able to get clearer. And I actually touched, you know, a tenderness too of that, because the sadness was real. This was, you know, the person was something worth losing, you know, that this is a huge thing to have lost. And so in that way, in that physical mm-hmm. way, the person's life is not there in that physical way. And so as I began to hold and touch that enormous piece of it, I realized, very vulnerable, number one, and number two, that in many ways, I'm like a lot of other people, you know, that I'm not just some solo person with solo grief. I'm not some oddball, but other people are experiencing this too. And we are connected in our grief. And something that I write in the book that Anne Morrow Lindbergh said, which is so wise, she said something like, you know, if suffering alone were redemptive, like everybody that suffers, you're stronger for it, that kind of truism, which I'm not sure, in some ways that just discounts the person suffering. But she said, you know, if suffering alone made a person wise, made a person redemptive, everybody would be redeemed. Everybody would be wise, because everybody's going to have suffering. But that's not what that's not what this is about. We have to do something with this that comes to us. We have to work with it. And actually, many people talk about this, that the work is to hold all the different sides of grief, the loss, the love, the unfinishedness of it, that roundedness of grief, that it's complex and it's round and it has many different parts to it, that is what is tending grief. And that when a person can do that, there's a kind of sense of wholeness. There's a beauty to that. There's a completeness to that. And that feels like, yeah, that's a big part of the work. But it's the, you know, the going kind of automatically to avoidance or to anger, or blaming the person, you should have taken better care of yourself, or shouldn't have been driving on this road, or whatever. That's a deflection. Mm. And it's useful, but in the short term, but in the long term, I don't know how useful that's going to be.
Can you talk about, I love this idea of exploring grief and digging under the surface to find that sadness, to find those other emotions that are below the surface, the ones that we don't want to face, we've been trying to avoid, or we get angry, or we don't want to go there. Sometimes our responses are also like just our personalities, it makes it more difficult. And like Valerie, like you have a legal mind, very logical, and some other people can be more emotional. And so sometimes going to those emotional spaces might be easier for some, but not so easy for others, just because of the way their brain operates. Like I want, maybe the logical mind is thinking, I need to, you know, give me the model, give me the step-by-step instructions on how do I go to find that sadness, right? Give me the actual process. Whereas others who maybe are more in tune with their own emotions can go there more easily and start to explore it. But can you give some advice for those who maybe just from their personality, like it's more difficult because they're more analytical and it's hard for them to like dig into the emotions?
Yeah, totally. You know, and I'm one of those people because, like I said, I mean, I was a closet meditator for many years. So the idea of, you know, no, that was not my thing. So I totally get that and I totally hear that. And yeah, I think that there's some real practical things that a person who's more in, like engineer brain kind of thinking, and I don't mean to denigrate an engineer's brain, or, you know, people have all kinds of neurodivergence and ways of thinking so I just want to say that up front. But say the person who is thinking from and wanting a kind of step by step, how do you actually get in touch with these feelings that are below what may be automatic? And the analogy, the best way I can describe it is what I did when I was a lobbyist, working as a lobbyist, and practicing meditation as a lobbyist. So as I said, you know, like a lot of people, I spent a lot of time working, and it's like, I don't have 15 minutes in the morning to sit in meditation. Are you kidding me? You know, I barely have time to get dressed and get out of the house, grab a coffee or something and eat in the car. And that may be the plight of the circumstance of a lot of people. And so it just made sense to me, like, why don't you start practicing meditation actually at work? Why wait? And why only have it like 5 minutes or 10 minutes or 15 minutes in the morning or in the evening? And so, you know, the beauty of meditation is that it's portable, this quality of mindful awareness, you know, that is open and aware of what's happening right now. You know, like I'm aware of my feet on the ground and my back against the chair. Like, you know, you can take this portability of awareness, and just connecting with that awareness, you're not like fast forward, what am I going to do after this? And I'm not thinking about in the past because I'm aware of my feet on the ground right here and right now. And again, that is really, really powerful, especially with, you know, the high stakes, high anxiety time that we live in. So what I would do at work, I would be in the halls of Congress or the state capitol, and I would start practicing meditation. And by that I mean, I would be in a business suit with heels on, and I would feel my feet on the marble floor. And then I would pay attention to how my body felt inside. Like, was I feeling tension? Was my stomach turned into a knot? Did I have a tension in my neck? Was my heart beating fast? And by paying attention to that, that gave me some information about how I was feeling. And I could then adjust, like, oh, my heart's racing. Maybe I better take a few breaths. Or I'm feeling tension in my shoulders and kind of relaxing, trying to relax a little bit more. So just paying attention to that, the state of my body, which is the state of my mind. And so when I would be in conversation with a person to, you know, to try to persuade them of something or another, some advocacy moment. You know, the work of a lobbyist is to try to persuade people to do stuff that they otherwise would not do. But, you know, to do that in a kind of skillful way. It could be someone who has a very different viewpoint from mine. And often it was that. And so what I would do is I would take sincere and genuine interest in the other person, like really ask them, how are they doing? And listening for understanding, not for correction or to try to take some advantage, but really to listen, to understand where the person was coming from. In fact, I wouldn't open my mouth to say anything if I didn't have sincere and genuine interest in the person. I'd stop myself. And in doing that, in taking sincere and genuine interest, in paying attention to what was happening in my own body, and then having the words that came out of my mouth come from this place of a genuine and sincere interest in the person, the space between us changed. There was a real sense of connectedness. And so for the person who is kind of inclined to, how do I begin to let in, to uncover these very strong emotions that may be deeply embedded, I would say begin by noticing your own body. Like, what is your stomach saying, you know, when these issues come up? Is there a tension that you're holding somewhere in your body? The body, we know that the body has its huge intelligence, and there's tremendous information there. We're communicating. In fact, much of the way we communicate with another human being, well over 90% is through the body, right? And so, how am I communicating? What is my body saying? And that gives a person a lot of data on what are the emotions happening. So starting there, what is my body saying to me about all of this? And I think for folks who, you know, we are, and myself included, I mean, a type A lawyer, I was like a walking cerebellum, you know, like just kind of cut off from this wisdom of my own body. But it's paying attention to what are those clues that the body is saying. And there is a lot of information there. And again, starting small, to be able to say, I'm noticing tensions in my chest. I wonder what that is about. Or I'm feeling my feet on, I can feel my feet on the ground. Does that help me feel a little bit more grounded and solid? You know, what is the shape of my body? Often the shape of our body is telling us a lot of information. And so I would say paying attention to that language of the body and what it's saying can be a real help.
I love those very, very practical tips. And also, like, just that way you describe things as data points. Like, what is your mind thinking about? How is your body feeling? Your stomach, your shoulders? Like, these are all data points pointing to something and helping us to think more critically about those things.
Absolutely. And, you know, we live in such a fast-paced world with so much data points coming at us. So to be able to notice, pause, you know, the stopping to just notice that, that's a victory. That's a big victory. And we don't have to take, 10 minutes, 15 minutes just to notice. Like, oh, you know, we tend to notice when we're really in, when we come to a critical mass of an emotion or a feeling or a state of being, like, I'm super hungry, right? Then, you know, then we know what happens. Or like, I'm super tired, and then, you know, you crash. Mm-hmm. But the body, before we get to that point, is giving small clues or maybe big clues. Yeah,
and I think my problem is that I often ignore not paying attention, or that's just some muscle ache in my neck if I'm not really drilling into it. But these are all like super, super helpful pieces of advice on how to be better in tune with our body and really listen to our bodies and really listen to the grief. And I love at the beginning of the conversation, you talk about how do we become really more tender to our grief, and how do we tend to our grief that's just there? Because when we go through these different painful experiences, they don't necessarily go away. These are people that we've loved, and they're going to be in our memories forever. How do we honor them? How do we tend to that? Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, for writing this book, Hope Leans Forward. Before we go, can you share with the listeners about where they can learn more about you, your books, and your retreats and other work that you do?
Oh, fabulous. Mike, it's been a delight. You can learn more about my work at my website, which is valeriebrown.us. That's valeriebrown.us. And there you'll find resources to pre-order the book now. For anyone who orders the book in pre-order now, it'll be published on November 8th of this year. But if you pre-order now, we have a gorgeous e-journal that is fillable. And really, the e-journal is great to help people do the kind of reflection. So it's filled with reflective questions and meditative practices. And lovely quotes from the book. So that's free, as well as a 20-minute audio-guided breathing meditation. We all need to relearn how to breathe very deeply. So that's free to your podcast listeners and to learn more about my work. So again, this is just an absolute delight to be here to share this with your audience.
Thanks so much, Valerie. And I'll make sure in the podcast notes, as well as the blog and the YouTube video, I'll have links over to valeriebrown.us so everyone can check out all the fantastic work you're doing to help others grow in awareness, grow in peace and compassion. So thank you so much, Valerie.
Thank you so much, Mike. It's been a delight.
Thank you. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Delgado Podcast. As always, you can get the show notes, video links, and resources mentioned in this episode on my blog at mikedelgado.org. You can also get updates to new shows and get access to the full archive of past shows by following the Delgado Podcast on YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you ever have suggestions for future topics or guests you want to hear from on this show, please reach out. My email is delgado@ucla.edu. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll chat more next time.